Coda. Under the Hood. At the tail end of 2023, I forced myself to leave the house to go to Tate Modern's Philip Guston show. I was off work and grieving my father, who 4 years earlier had died suddenly of a massive stroke. I was averse to the prospect of going out, to the flood of strangers on the tube, to the exhibition crowds and their earnest curiosity or poorly concealed boredom. I preferred to stay at home and nurse my grudge against the world. But I also knew that I'd be back at work in a few days, and if I didn't go soon, I'd miss it. During the first weeks of mourning, every little dilemma of this kind aroused in me a wave of resentment, as though daily life was holding me to ransom, like an unimaginative parent. No X for you if you don't do Y. "I don't want to," I wanted to scream back. But who was I going to scream at now? I got on the tube instead. The abstract canvases of the first rooms, each one a vortex of painterly intensity, cast a deep spell over me. They culminated in the ghostly heads of paintings made in the mid-60s, which peered out from inside square cages of thick, compacted black, staring into the dark inside of my own. These pictures paved the way for the figurative explosions in Guston's work that followed over the next few years, but nothing prepared me for this muted orgy of colours and things, and especially not for Guston's notorious hood paintings, the hapless stooges in clan cloaks idling, driving, and painting their way through the world, the smears and scraps of their evil-doing just perceptible behind or around them. The museum label informed me that 33 of these paintings were shown in a major exhibition at the Marlborough Gallery in New York between October and November 1970. This was the month of my birth, I noted, as though the paintings were a kind of bespoke commentary on the state of the world at the point of my entry into it. Grief can feel like being shrouded in narcissistic fog. Everything seems to be about you. The New York art world received these paintings in bafflement and disgust. With a few exceptions, artists and critics reacted with sneering distaste to the comic strip reductionism, lurid palette, and clan imagery, wondering how Guston could have gone from the sublime abstractionist of a decade ago to these shambolic tableau of chromatic and political chaos. Some friends, notably the avant-garde composer Morton Feldman, cut off contact with him altogether after leaving the gallery. One painting snared my gaze and held it at a standstill. The Studio, 1969. Against a trademark candy pink wall muted by the greys and whites pressing through it, and surrounded by the clutter of the painter's studio, a hooded clansman presses a brush to the canvas with his oversized blood-red right hand. Splotches of red, blood or paint, spatter the lower fold of his white cloak. The image forming on the canvas is himself. The painting speaks to us from a moment fraught with violence and menace in America and the world beyond. Guston painted it as war was raging in Vietnam. A resurgent Klan had been terrorizing black communities in the South for decades, and Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated in April of the previous year, sparking riots in cities across the country. Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated in June, while in August police had brutalized crowds outside the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Looking at the painting, it reminded me of the mire of our own moment of spreading violence and authoritarian zeal. The previous, and perhaps next, US president is a revered icon of the KKK, mainstreaming white supremacy in ways they could only have dreamed of. As global heating and war drive larger and more urgent streams of mass migration, the UK and many of its European neighbours cultivate a hostile environment for migrants and asylum seekers, deliberately engineering their destitution. Guston's words from the period of the Studio, printed on another wall label, resonate today. So when the 1960s came along, I was feeling split, schizophrenic. The war, what was happening to America, the brutality of the world. What kind of a man am I, sitting at home, reading magazines, going into a frustrated fury about everything, and then going into my studio to adjust a red to a blue? What kind of man am I? I felt like I couldn't move, a physical stuckness, both vertiginous and distressing, a disorientation at once physical, emotional, and moral. The picture seemed to speak my own frustrated fury and inability to find a usable outlet for it. The flouting of perspective amplified this sense of inadequacy, as though making visible my own difficulty in mapping the world and my place in it. Freud writes that in the unconscious, two contradictory realities can sit alongside one another, exempt from mutual contradiction. This phenomenon is familiar to us from our dream life, where we can be simultaneously in one place and another, where people can be both themselves and someone else. It was my dad, only not my dad. Guston's late paintings look like a snapshot of this landscape of the unconscious. Instead of a stable, perspectival space in which one thing is clearly marked off from another, all differentiations collapse into the chaotic flatness of the canvas. Painting, wrote Guston, is really this metaphysical plane where the condition exists of no finish, no end, but infinite continuity. In the space of the studio, the light bulb appears to hang at once in front of and beside the clock, just as the grey plume of cigarette smoke in front of the painting could double as a stain on the back wall. Is that a curtain of red fabric hovering from the top of the canvas, or just a different colour on the wall? The spatial regime of the world of the painting looks flimsy and vulnerable, on the verge of caving in. In psychoanalysis, that regime, conferring structure and coherence on the world, is known as the paternal order. If I had to go to an exhibition in the first flush of grief for a father, this felt like the one to choose, or possibly the one to avoid at all costs. The painter painting himself painting, a classic mise en abîme in the centre of the canvas, but also spilling out of it. The first invisible link in this chain of self-painters is the painter of the studio, into whose perspective the painting railroads us, inserting us into its infinite play of mirrors. You don't get to see this scene from a comfortable distance. If you really want to look at it, you have to get inside it. You have to look under the hood. In the beginning, the canvas is empty, and you can do anything. And that's the most frightening experience, said Guston in a 1980 interview. Glossing this remark, the critic Mark Godfrey notes that Guston paints not from the observation of an existing reality, but as the creator of a new reality, summoning images into existence as Genesis describes God bringing into being the parts of a world. The point here is that you cannot navigate this created world by reference to the world you already know. You can only enter it on the terms set by the paintings themselves, and this enforced compact with them makes you feel queasy and angry. How many paintings have made me want to turn away in relief as though the real world were preferable? Entartete Kunst, degenerate art, comes to mind, the Nazi term for the distortions and contortions of modernist lines and colours, its products exhibited to the German public in 1937 to warn of what happens when the degenerate Jewish spirit is left free to contaminate and pervert the ideal rectitude of classical Aryan order and morality. Had my own gaze been infiltrated by this Nazi spirit, was I looking away in disgust from these degenerate images, reaching for the paternal order corroded by the ugly horrors of this Jewish artist's perverse imagination? Was I looking at the paintings from under a hood, feeling somewhere the furious urge to burn them? There is a Guston painting of 1970, Flatlands, in which two hooded figures float blankly across the middle of a flat white desert, a wasteland of abandoned objects which are recurrent motifs of the whole series of paintings, a child's orange sun on the same undifferentiated plane as clocks, hanging blank canvases, a tree stump, but also an amputated foot, a pair of shoed human legs clad in what looks suspiciously like striped concentration camp pyjamas. The traumatic historical reference is overlain disturbingly by a pop culture reference, legs poking out horizontally from the edge of a comic strip frame, known as the plop take, denote a comedy pratfall. I was reminded that when actors start laughing uncontrollably on stage, they call it corpsing. The more I looked around, the more I noticed these mutual adulterations of laughter and horror. In another 1970 canvas, Caught, a gloved hand, unsettlingly like Mickey Mouse's, descends from the sky to point accusingly at a pair of hooded Klansmen sat in their jalopy, who stare at it like frightened rabbits, little red bullets of sweat pouring down their cloaks. The same hand is appended to a black forearm, bursting through the right edge of the frame in Courtroom, also 1970, Its finger of judgment pointed squarely at the Klansman, who stares at it in who-me bewilderment from under his blood-stained cloak, even as the striped trousered legs of an upside-down corpse poke out of the dock behind him. The gag ruins the gravitas of moral horror and lamentation, just as the intimations of hate and murder ruin the gag, although it's equally true that they are the gag. Gustin is another child of Jewish refugees from Tsarist Russia, born 20 years after Wolf Sachs, the South African psychoanalyst, who found himself entangled in and seeking to shed light on black anger. Like Sachs, though by very different means, he comes to see that he will get nowhere in this task unless he turns his gaze critically on himself. White Americans seem to feel that happy songs are happy and that sad songs are sad, Baldwin had written 6 years previously. Gustin's paintings put paid to this emotional complacency. Adapting Baldwin's formulation, we might say that Gustin emphatically doesn't feel his angry paintings are angry. He declines to take refuge in the cozy knowledge of being right. There is no moral vanishing point from which to view and judge the actors in these paintings. The finger-pointing hand of court and courtroom is intruding from outside the frame as though haughtily refusing to implicate itself in the picture. Rather than orienting and organizing our gaze, it's just another element in the chaos. The slapstick Klansmen of these paintings are not stock embodiments of pure evil. Their bodily comportment suggests sadness, loneliness, vulnerability. Stare at the vertical black slit through which their eyes peer, and you might see uncertainty, guilt, embarrassment, and desolation staring back at you. These are certainly paintings to make you feel angry, but they will make you feel a lot of other things as well. Anger is most rigid when it's angry to the exclusion of other feelings, and most alive and creative where it dares to make contact with other feelings. That afternoon in the Tate, I didn't just see the Klansman's feelings, I inhabited them, wore them like a cloak I couldn't take off. I was furious at the paintings for exposing me to places in myself I wanted to avoid. I was grateful to the paintings for speaking my rage at the fact that nothing had changed between the moment of my birth and this one, for screaming my infantile rage at my father for leaving this world without having fixed it. I trembled with anger, but also with laughter, and also with tears. And it was difficult to tell the difference.